Concerns about the environment lead to all kinds of actions, and some of them just don't work out the way people planned. Case in point, setting up fish management zones to make sure that fish stocks are not depleted by commercial boats. You'll hear a case in which setting up those zones actually led to more fishing in the short term. Those are the kinds of cases that interest Grant McDermott, an assistant professor of economics at the University of Oregon. His work tends to focus on climate, energy, water, and fisheries, and he's our guest in this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio, our joint venture with the University of Oregon. Grant, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
We should underscore up front that you are an economist, not a biologist, but you do extensive work on the environment. How did this end up being your focus?
I know, guilty as charged. So I have a kind of a circular route to becoming an academic. I always tell people I'm an accidental academic. But I did an undergraduate in economics, and I had a longstanding interest in the environment. I grew up, you can probably tell from my accent, in Southern Africa, and we would constantly go to game parks and so forth. And I just think I found my, I would say my niche, but I'm learning to say my niche here in this particular field. And I think my particular skill set is just there's a fortuitous moment in time where we're getting better data sets and increased knowledge about our natural world through the use of remote sensing, which is satellite information and so forth. And my training is in a lot of that sort of that area, dealing with larger data sets and so forth. So it's kind of been a lucky route to get me here.
And it seems like a good moment in history too, Grant, because when you think about the fact that very often when environmentalists propose changes to extractive industries, fishing being one of them, that they're met with a response like, well, you know, we have to deal with what the market will handle. And this is really about trying to get the market to work as part of the system, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very profound insight you've made. And I think, so, and to kind of riff off the previous point too, what I'm interested in is the duality of the environmental factors, but also sort of human behavior and responses, you know, incentives and that kind of thing. And as you say, depends what the market will bear, but often there's no market for these goods at all, and that complicates things. And one of my colleagues at the U of O, Trudy Cameron, is a pioneer in dealing with non-market goods, so goods that aren't traded in markets, and we as environmental economists are trying to develop tools and techniques to integrate those two systems, you know, the environment and the economy, because there is a strong dependence across them, and even if that correspondence isn't always clear.
So when you say there's no markets for them, is this like people don't believe in having to pay for ecosystem services, like, you know, cooler air from the shade of trees, that sort of thing?
Yeah, cooler air from shade is a great example. I mean, that probably gets capitalized in house prices somewhat, but there's many environmental goods that just aren't traded. And that's not to say we don't care for them, but you can't go to Walmart and buy a quart of clean air, for example. You know, so we need to have some kind of regulatory system in place, and even things like water. So my home city of Cape Town, there's a crazy water crisis at the moment. And part of the problem there is that water just isn't correctly priced in the market like it would be other goods. There's a slew of factors underlying that. But even other things like, you know, it's hard to put a price on the value of the last, you know, polar bear. I'm just taking a kind of a deliberately heart-tugging example. But, you know, we don't trade markets like we do go and buy bread and milk and all sorts of other things. So we need to think of creative or other regulatory ways to incorporate those things into our everyday decision-making.
Grant McDermott is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange and assistant professor of economics at the University of Oregon. He's been studying fisheries heavily for a while now. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about things that are done to make sure that the environment succeeds and yet things that may backfire as well. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Grant, I noticed earlier this year you put out a paper on how not to overfish. Can people who fish for a living still make a good living and help preserve the fish stocks?
Yes, I think that's certainly possible. I'm not saying that there aren't some short-term trade-offs, but some colleagues of mine put up, there's been a sort of a triptych of papers, if I can call it that, have come out recently trying to show that they can achieve something like a triple bottom line, where you can achieve maximized profits, maximized biomass, so that's the number of fish, in the ocean and some other maximized conservation goals. And the reason really is because you set the right structure of incentives for fishing. At the moment, in a lot of places in the world, it's just a free-for-all, and that's not a sustainable situation. So fishermen are just going in and fishing as much as they can as quick as they can, and because their neighbors are doing it, and that creates a sort of self-reinforcing negative spiral. So if we can put the right structures in place, we can avoid that sort of tragedy of the commons, and that ensures long-term sustainability for these fishing industries. And that's not to say there aren't some trade-offs and some political bargaining that needs to happen, but I think everyone is in universal agreement that has studied these issues in depth that if you can put those right structures in place, so thinking about things like catch shares and so forth, you can help both the economies of these small fishing towns and also the environmental stocks rebound.
So when you say catches, you mean catch limits, that sorts of things, like, you know, X number of fish per day, per month, per season, that kind of thing?
That's one example. Typically, what we think about in fisheries economics now is trying to put in a lot of environmental economics, in fact, you try to assign some kind of property right to the resource. So we talk a lot about carbon taxes and carbon prices. That's really about assigning a property right to clean air or to air that doesn't have some large fraction of CO2 in it. And in fisheries, we might assign catch rights to a certain number of fish, and then you could trade those rights, again, trying to bring the markets to the environmental component. So just like you would be able to sell, you know, land or any other good that we trade in a market, we can go and do the same for these fish stocks. So a fisherman might have rights to catch, let's say, 1,000 fish, and then he or she might decide that they want to sell those rights to someone else who thinks they can do better and is willing to pay the appropriate price for them.
Do people make the adjustments easily? I mean, I ask this because there's a great example of where it didn't work, or where people just didn't stop fishing in time, and we had a situation like the collapse of the Atlantic cod fishery.
Ah, yes. So the Atlantic cod collapse is one of the most famous in the canon, so to speak. I don't think they put in the correct structures there. So we've seen some fisheries rebound dramatically because they did manage to put in the appropriate structures. And so, you know, Australia and New Zealand are classic examples. Also, we've seen really positive developments along the west coast of the U.S. now since a lot of those negative cases. So it has worked. Well, at least that's what it looks to be doing. And not every fishery is on the verge of collapse. So that's a bit of alarmism when you hear that. But there are parts of the ocean, particularly in the developing world, west coast of Africa and parts of Asia, where it's tremendously overfished. And there it still is a free-for-all. And the idea underlying this property rights mechanism is that it creates, again, the incentive for the owners of those resources to conserve them. There's not this sort of use it now or not have access to it in the future. And I guess we'll discuss some of that mechanism a little later in the show when we talk about the blue paradox, which is some of my more recent research.
Exactly. Well, you set it up well. Let me remind folks, we're talking to Grant McDermott at the University of Oregon. He is this month's guest in our regular series with the university called Curious Research Meets Radio. He's an assistant professor of economics who studies a lot of environmental effects of things that people do in relation with each other and with the environment. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the blue paradox, this is the one in which you actually set up or you observe the setup of management zones, and yet just saying that those were going to happen actually increased fishing in the short term?
Yeah, so it's kind of this perverse effect. And the way I kind of try to lay it out to sort of different audiences is to give some other examples. But the summary version is, can you actually make a problem worse by promising to solve it? And we see this across a variety of different fields. Where sort of unintended consequences of policy. A kind of famous example is whenever Congress begins debating gun control, gun sales increase. And I'm not trying to take a political stand on that. I'm just trying to say that the intended goal of the participants, so here the people trying to advocate for gun control, led to, in their minds, a perverse increase in the sale of guns. And we see it in the environmental realm as well. So the Endangered Species Act, when you have a species that gets newly listed in, for example, the red cock-headed woodpecker, what happens is its habitat actually gets preemptively cut down, because landowners know that if a colony or a breeding pair settles on their land, they won't ever be able to, you know, cut down those trees again or harvest those trees. So they just, it's a use it or lose it mechanism, and that's what they predictably go for. Now, in the case of the ocean, that effect hasn't really been well studied, and there's a variety of reasons for that. One of the key ones is that the data just haven't existed before, but thanks to kind of a new initiative, in particular the Global Fishing Watch, which provides satellite-based data or information on fishing activity. It provides an unprecedented viewpoint into fishing activity that's happening far away from land. So that's been out of sight, out of mind until now. And that lets us look at whether these sort of similar preemptive effects are happening in the ocean. And we do pick that up. And the area that we look at in particular is part of the Equatorial Pacific. It's an area called the Phoenix Island Protected Area, or PIPA. It's roughly the size of California, and it has been a widely celebrated case study for conservation, because we know that when it was enforced at the beginning of 2015, fishing activity ceased, and it's a very pristine, beautiful area. So it's kind of become the poster child, you know, for this environmental movement. And we as economists have come in there and poured a bit of cold water on the story, because we've said, well, what happens beforehand? Do we see these same preemptive effects that we see on land in these multiple different cases? And unfortunately, we do.
So in other words, as the people who own the timber cut down the trees to make sure that they didn't get caught with an endangered woodpecker in it, the guys out there fishing made sure they got the fish before the restrictions went into effect.
Precisely. So it's, again, the same underlying mechanism. Now, what makes this particularly interesting, and I'll just give the magnitude of the effect first. So we find, again, because the data are so detailed, they allow us to back out sort of precise magnitudes, and we find that the increase in fishing, and again, it just jumps out at you if you look at the data, is equivalent to roughly about 1.5 years of no fishing. So it's going to take, the ban's going to have to be in place for 1.5 years before the fishing reserve even breaks even. And again, this is something the size of, this is the reserve the size of California. So it's a big deal. There's a lot of fish there. Now, what makes this kind of interesting and unexpected is that I've spoken a lot about property rights and how this is the driver behind some of this anticipatory behavior on land. Property rights are far from secure in the ocean. So it's pretty surprising that we still see this effect. And we have a couple of speculate about a couple of reasons that that could be driving this. But I think that's another reason why people haven't paid attention to it previously in the literature.
So Grant McDermott, in this example then, the Phoenix Island Protected Area, what might have been done differently in your analysis that might have kept the overfishing from going on before the restrictions on fishing went into effect?
Yeah, so this is a tricky question, and one that we've wrestled with a lot in the paper. So the simple answer is something that could have been done. This anticipatory surge in fishing happened over a course of about 15 months before the enforcement went into place. So you might think immediately, well, why don't we just shorten the, let's call it the announcement, and then the actual enforcement, the gap between those two periods. And that is one potential solution. You know, you could just say, okay, we're deciding today, and then in a month's time, we're going to close down this fishing area. Now, the problem with that is it takes a long time to establish the political capital to put these reserves into place. You need blue ribbon panels, you need stakeholder involvement, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of glib for me to say, okay, let's just shorten that period. But that's a decent option on the table. And I do think that you might have periods that are unduly long. You know, they're trying to just secure an extra round of funding for a marginal amount of extra area into this reserve. So that's one thing we could do. We could have a conversation about shortening the lead time between the actual enforcement. Another thing that we could possibly talk about is having some kind of transition phase. So going from this, from whatever the previous regime is, so either no regulation or some other kind of quasi-property rights regulation that's been in place, having a transition phase with a different kind of regulatory structure before we get to the no-take reserve. And I think that, again, would kind of modulate or moderate, I should say, some of those anticipatory effects that we see. But it's a difficult thing. And part of the motivation in writing this paper is just to make these trade-offs explicit and not to say that we have the silver bullet for solving them, but to say, hey, here's something we haven't really thought about properly. It appears to be very clear from the data. Now, what does this mean for us? And one thing it means is that, okay, perhaps we can't overcome it completely, but then at least we should moderate our expectations about how successful these reserves will be and how long they'll take to before they become successful. And I think that's an important conversation that needs to happen because in the background, a lot of these so-called marine reserves, and again, for your listeners, that's like a national park out at sea. It's an area where there's no fishing allowed. A lot of these marine reserves haven't been as successful as their champions thought they would be, their advocates, And that's not because they don't have a sound biological or ecological basis. They do. But maybe it has something to do with the human behavioral response that's kind of more tied to economics, as we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, the use it or lose it idea. That's a really interesting thing when it comes to the environment and sustainability. Grant, just a few seconds left. I understand you have a pub talk coming up this week. You're going to be talking about the same sort of stuff?
Yeah, so I actually should have looked up the location before this conversation.
But it looks like it's Downtown Athletic Club.
Jeff, you've got my back. Thanks.
Sure.
That's where it is. Yeah, and it's open to the general public. I'd love to take questions, and all are welcome. I promise to use more pictures than text, so hopefully it'll be more exciting in the flesh. And there'll be free drinks. No, there won't be free drinks, but there'll be drinks. Well, at least, so
that's off the table. All right. That's a quack chat coming up on Wednesday at 6, it looks like, at the Downtown Athletic Club in Eugene. So it's a good time for us to have Grant McDermott on. He is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Oregon and studying things like fisheries. He's been our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio, our joint venture with the University of Oregon. Grant, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeff.